Good Sunday to all of you. We thought this would be a good chance for John and I to go back and take a look at the previous offseason. Since we have this hiatus, we don't know entirely how the season worked out yet, but we've got a lot of information now to look at some of the big moves that took place. We obviously were discussing those in real time when they happened, at least those of us who were actually in the media at the time. So we're going to look now at the 2019 offseason, some of the best moves, some of the worst moves, some of the moves that we've really had to change our opinions on. So, John, good day. How you doing, man?
Doing great. Just trying to survive in isolation like all of us.
So I guess we could just get right into it here. What did you have? What did you have as some of your best moves? Or I guess I don't know if we want to describe it as the best move, but a move that really you thought looks amazing in retrospect.
Well, I think this is pretty clearly going to go down as the best move. And that would be Oklahoma City receiving Danilo Gallinari, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and 5 first-round picks from the LA Clippers for Paul George. You look back and, I mean, certainly if you look just back at this season, you would say if it was Gallinari and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Oklahoma City probably made out okay. And those are the kinds of deals teams have to take sometimes when they have a gun to their head and a guy wants out. But fortunately, they were able to leverage Kawhi Leonard's situation in concert with George for all it was worth and get 5 additional first-round picks, including an unprotected first from Miami in 21. There's a pick swap in there as well in 23, which we'll see how that goes. There's another pick from Miami in there that's protected later this decade. And then they get picks in 25 and 26, where it's like, who knows what the Clippers are going to be by then. I'm sorry, there's a swap in 25 and a real pick in 26. I just thought they did amazingly well out of that.
Yeah, it's probably the biggest return ever, at least at the time, for a superstar. And they benefited from the fact that the Clippers were essentially trading for 2 players because Kawhi was going to sign there if they got George. And they managed to leverage that extremely well. And it only looks better now than it did then because they now are probably actually a better team this year than they were last year, at least in terms of their record.
Yeah. I think in terms of the quality of the team and the starting lineup, I think too. We get into another trade that played into that too, I think. But
well, how does this look in retrospect to you from the Clippers' standpoint? It seemed like the consensus at the time was it was a win-win. Do you still see it that way?
I still see it that way because, I mean, getting Kawhi was clearly the most important part. So obviously, I mean, they wildly overpaid on this, but they also got Kawhi Leonard for free. So if that's part of the transaction, it's tough to lose the other part of it badly enough that you would come out worse, right?
Yeah.
Especially when you have both players locked up for multiple years. So I still think the Clippers do that again. Now, did they get a little too exuberant? Could they have held the line a little more? Maybe, but the clock was running out on them too, was the problem.
Yeah, they were concerned that Kawhi was going to go to the Lakers.
Exactly. So there's a playing defense component to this as well, because they not only got them on their team, but they kept them away from the team that would have certainly dominated the Western Conference for many years to come if they had been able to pull this off and get Kawhi Leonard. And what's amazing is that Anthony Davis also got traded this summer, and New Orleans, everyone felt like, got a pretty good haul out of it, and yet Oklahoma City's haul still dwarfed that that the Pelicans got for Davis.
That's an interesting question. Did it dwarf it? If we really look at it, I mean, Brandon Ingram made the All-Star team this year. Probably maybe didn't deserve that, but he's going to get a max contract, you'd think, in the offseason. Lonzo Ball looking like a quality starter. They got the number 4 pick, which they traded for a bunch of stuff, which may or may not work out. But that, I mean, the number 4 pick is arguably, I mean, granted, it wasn't a great draft, but you would imagine that the number 4 pick is probably going to be higher than any individual pick that OKC got.
That's fair. Yes. Yeah.
Now, Gilgeous-Alexander, whether he is better than Ingram or not, I think Gilgeous-Alexander had more value at the time. Ingram might have more value now than Gilgeous-Alexander. So, and then they also still have these 2 picks coming from the Lakers, one of which is that crazy deferment.
Exactly. Unprotected in 24 that they can defer to 25. That is, a high value asset. If you look at the, if you look at LeBron's birth certificate, I mean, that that could really be worth something.
So yeah, but I think ultimately, though, for the Clippers, this was going to be worth it if they were a championship level team, and it seemed like they were rounding into that kind of form. So I think you would have to say it looks about the same as the Clippers to me were about what I thought they were going to be, and Oklahoma City was better. So I still think it was ended up being a win-win. I mean, it really would have required the Clippers to play poker with Kawhi Leonard really more than Oklahoma City. Because Oklahoma City knew they needed a commitment immediately. And who knows, maybe Kawhi would have never gone to the Lakers or Toronto, even if they hadn't gotten Paul George. And you could also make the argument that, hey, maybe the Clippers would have been better if they had just retained all of these assets. And then they could have traded some of those for other stuff as well at a future time. They would have still had Gilgeous Alexander, who could have grown with Kawhi. Gallinari would have helped them still. So they might have even been better if they had just gotten Kawhi, but Kawhi wanted another superstar with him.
And exactly.
In the playoffs, that may end up being the better strategy anyway.
Very true. Very true.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you'd have to say that's probably the best move. When you get more in trade, maybe for a superstar than anyone has ever got, at least at the time, and it's Paul George, who's a good player, but he's, you know, like the 10th right. best player in the NBA or something. He's not, you know, we're not talking about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar getting traded in 1975 here.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So that one to me is still the one that blows me away. And you know, those Gilgeous Alexander and Gallinari were both good this year. You know, we'll see if they're able to keep Gallinari or what happens there. But I just think that's the move that stood out the most to me.
Well, so this one didn't stand out that much because it wasn't seismic for the league. But in terms of just a move that worked out amazingly well,
okay,
taking on TJ Warren
yes.
and picking up the number 32 overall pick, which they later traded for 3 second rounders from Miami for the low, low price of cash from the Phoenix Suns. And now TJ Warren has turned into a very solid two-way starter. I think he's outperformed that contract this year. And you got a valuable pick as well. That was pretty solid, I think.
That was really good work. They got what's amazing. Yeah, so it wasn't just a second that Phoenix sent them. They sent them the 32nd pick in the draft, which theoretically yeah. had some value. Now, the guy Miami drafted maybe wouldn't have been my first choice there, KZ Okpala, but Indiana flipped that pick to Miami and got 3 future seconds from the Heat in 22, 25, and 26. And I think those picks, especially in 25 and 26 from Miami, could end up being pretty high 30s. So, just a great job by Indiana turning essentially nothing, right, into a high-level starting small forward and picks.
Well, and it really was a success at every level of the organization, right? Because for one, it's an understanding of what else is out there in free agency. They still were able to pick up Malcolm Brogdon and Jeremy Lamb as well, and TJ McConnell while still, so they, it's not like they were going to do anything else with that $12 million in space from Warren's contract that they took on. It was also an understanding that Warren hadn't been in a great situation in Phoenix, and that they have this track record of getting guys with physical ability to defend when maybe they hadn't before, and that's exactly what they were able to do with him. So the idea that they could get him as, in theory, a distressed asset, although I didn't even necessarily think of him as that before this. I thought this was a good move for Indiana at the time, but then to make him into even a much better player was very impressive.
Absolutely. And kind of a bizarre move by Phoenix, because they could have done the same thing by via a couple other means. Obviously, they weren't required to sign Kelly Oubre, obviously was the main thing, but they could have gotten there a couple other ways even without that, and didn't for whatever reason.
Well, yeah, in theory, they were using that room to help sign Ricky Rubio, which they were able to do after they dumped Josh Jackson as well. And Rubio, I mean, to me, Rubio probably helped them more than Warren would have this year. So I think there's something to be said for that. Also ironic, because Indiana was rumored to be in the Rubio sweepstakes. They then get Malcolm Brogdon instead and take on TJ Warren, which enables Phoenix to sign Ricky Rubio.
Yeah, it's a whole connected circle right there. I'd say the Pacers came out of that better than the Suns did, certainly. Rubio definitely, I mean, he helped Phoenix. There's no question. That was a solid move that the Suns made to sign him. But they gave up a lot of stuff in order to affect that transaction. I think there's another move we're going to end up talking about here, too, that was part of that.
Okay, what's well, here, let's take a quick break and then we'll get to John's next move that he really liked. Our friends at Echelon are finally making connected home fitness accessible for those who don't want to pay a ton for a Peloton. Go to echelonfit.com to discover their EX1 connected fitness bikes that offer a high-quality at-home cycling experience at less than half the price of a Peloton. You can buy an Echelon bike today for under $1,000 at Echelon Fit, like upper echelon, E-C-H-E-L-O-N, echelonfit.com/LONBA, abbreviating the name of this network. The beauty of Echelon is if you aren't 100% satisfied, they're going to give you your money back. They've got daily live and on-demand studio classes right in your home. You'll never have to step foot in a gym. Whatever your activity level, whether you're a first responder, elite athlete, a busy parent, and it's not just their connected fitness bikes. They also have a whole arsenal of high-tech fitness products at prices anyone can afford, like their Reflect Mirror that brings first-in-class fitness instruction to your home, or their all-new rowing machine that they are releasing later this month. So give it a shot at echelonfit.com/LONBA. And if you go to that echelonfit.com/LONBA link, you can learn about their limited time, free Apple iPad, and complete details of their exclusive offer. Echelon, it's your time. And don't forget to go to echelonfit.com/LONBA to let them know that you came from us. Actually, now that I think about it, maybe we should do, let's just alternate between good and bad. Maybe that's more interesting.
Okay.
What is the move that you, the number one move that sticks out that you didn't like?
The entire Knicks offseason, I just had it looped as one thing.
I have written on my sheet, everything the Knicks did, ?
Yeah.
Take us through it.
Okay, well, so here's the thing. The Knicks had a bunch of cap room that was going to end up going unused when all their first choices on free agency decided not to go there. You know, Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, which, okay, that happens. What the other teams that had cap room did, most notably Memphis, but you saw Atlanta do it. You saw a couple other teams with room do this. Even the Clippers did this, actually, with some leftover room they had. They got a first-round pick from Miami to take on Mo Harkless with their cap room. Indiana did it in the Warren deal we just talked about. The Knicks could have done basically all those deals. Perhaps not the Warren deal because it was before the draft, so they probably were still hoarding their room. But what the Knicks did instead was sign Julius Randle, Bobby Portis, Elfrid Payton, Wayne Ellington, Reggie Bullock, Marcus Morris, for a total of, what, like $70 million a year? Oh, Taj Gibson. I left him out. Sorry, very important player.
Yeah.
So basically, they nuked all their cap space on middling veterans on completely overpaid deals. And for what? So that they could win 28 games instead of 25. And the thing is, then they lost the ability to make trades like the trades these other teams made, where they were paid in draft picks to soak up cap space. And some of the players who were moved in those trades were actually better than the players the Knicks ended up signing. You know, if you look at Harkless, you look at Andre Iguodala, you look at, Josh Jackson and DeAnthony Melton. You look at Warren, obviously, we talked about before. The Knicks ended up with, Marcus Morris had value, and they ended up converting him to a late first, so they got something out of that, but like...
Yeah, although they completely blundered into him at the end. Let's not forget that.
Oh, yes, that's a good point. After Reggie Bullock failed his physical, and they ended up getting him at a lower number after that. And then, like Wayne Ellington at $8 million, Taj Gibson at $9 million. What are you doing, guys? Like, where are you going with this? Bobby Portis, $15 million. Come on, guys. They wasted that asset of their cap space and they got basically zero return for it. And now they'll end up, most of these guys are on 1+1 deals where the second year has a small guarantee.
Yeah, I usually call those 2-1s.
2-1, exactly.
Well, as opposed to the 1+1 is the player option.
Where you know the day it's signed that they're not picking up the second year. Yeah.
Well, I think of a 1+1 is the player option.
Yeah.
So a 2-1 is the team option or a non-guarantee.
Yeah, so they probably actually will pick up the Bullock guarantee. It's only $4.2 million, but Wayne Ellington, Taj Gibson, Bobby Portis is a team option, probably even Elfrid Payton, probably going to end up waiving or not picking up the options on all those guys. So that they're going to have nothing to show for it except more of Julius Randle hoovering up all Mitchell Robinson's minutes.
So I actually think that this looks a little bit better than it did at the time. I agree with all of what you said. I think that they're... many people have said, oh, they could have used their cap space to soak up room. And yes, they could have. There are a lot of really good deals that came out for that. But if there were another team in the market to do that, then the projected return would have gone down. So that's part of it, where they would have been competing with each other to take on, say, Andre Iguodala's salary. And so you don't necessarily get, if there's two teams competing, a top four protected pick in 2024, just as an example, or the same thing with Harkless. So that's one component that mitigates. I mean, I still think that might have been the better strategy. Number two, they signed Marcus Morris. They had got some modicum of respectability out of him, and then they traded him for that Clippers pick, which will probably be, you know, like the 27th pick in the draft. And so that's the type of level of pick that might have been available. They actually, when you look at Marcus Morris for $15 million, that's actually a pretty good return to get a guy for $15 million. He actually plays for you, and then you're able to trade him. So
I agree with that.
So they did get a little bit of something. They at least avoided going the route of, well, let's use up all our space to sign guys to 3 and 4 year deals and short circuit the rebuild. But the biggest problem to me was just the guys they got didn't fit together. I actually think Wayne Ellington was fine because he can actually shoot. Now, he had some injury issues and they wanted to play other players, but to go with Elfrid Payton, Gibson, Portis, and then not fit those guys around RJ Barrett. That's the biggest issue, is that
and
had
Randle.
This total.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. None of the pieces even fit. Yeah.
Even Randle, I might have been okay with if they just had, you know, if it's RJ and Randle and a bunch of guys who can shoot, you know, that might actually been okay to me, right? Like Randle, I think we forget how good a year he had last year in New Orleans. He also has been just not put in position to succeed at all. He's atrocious defensively. We get that, but it didn't seem crazy to me to give him, you know, a 3-1 at $20 million at the time and just see whether he worked out. He's young enough that maybe he would. But if they had just done this same strategy with a few different players, some of whom could actually stand behind that little arc that goes around the basket at 23 feet 9 inches, I would have felt a lot better about what they did.
That's fair. Yeah. I don't know. Some of it just, it was like a 1990s strategy, right? It was like, yeah, we're going to get all these tough fours and fives and, you know.
Yeah. We're going to go back to the days when Anthony Mason and Anthony Bonner were our small forwards.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty amazing to me that Anthony Mason at one point played small forward. There's a reason those 90s Knicks teams were some of the greatest defensive teams of all time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I got another one here. This is a small one. Detroit Pistons claimed Christian Wood on waivers from the New Orleans Pelicans.
Oh, that's a good one. And then nearly screwed it up by signing a 100-year-old Joe Johnson out of a half-court 3-on-3 league and giving him a partial. And
hey, don't you dare denigrate that league. That may be all we have in about 2 weeks here.
And somehow, some way, they managed not to screw it up, kept Christian Wood, and obviously he had a fantastic season. I was going through some statistics stuff since I've been kind of treating this hiatus as the off season. I mean, analytics-wise, he rated as a top 10 center this year. Like, he was good.
Yeah.
And to get him...
Glad to hear you recovered from coronavirus, by the way. That's
Yes, that's the most important thing.
Congratulations to him on that. But yeah, that's... and so I don't know. I mean, we'll see what he ends up getting. They have full bird. I think they have early bird rights on him.
I believe he's an early bird free agent. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
But that'll hopefully be enough for them to retain him.
Well, they're a room team too. So I think basically, if they want to, they can probably
that's
keep
true.
Him. The more interesting thing is if they keep him without having to renounce his hold, right? Then they can use a lot more cap room on other players. So that's where it gets a little interesting for them. New Orleans keeping Jahlil Okafor over Christian Wood, by the way, was a mistake.
Yeah, that was not good. I guess that was two good ones actually that I just did, so I owe you guys two bad ones after this. Okay, give me another good move that
All
you
right.
were.
So here's a good move that I think was probably the only contender for like on the level of that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander deal, which was Memphis turning Mike Conley into Brandon Clark, a future first from Utah, a $25 million trade exception that turned into another first from Golden State, and Josh Jackson and DeAnthony Melton, and a second and possibly 2 seconds from Phoenix.
You forgot Grayson Allen.
Yeah, that was kind of intentional. but he was a throw into that deal and whatever. We'll see what happens with him. I'm not like super optimistic there, but they got a lot of value for Conley, but then obviously setting the trade up in such a way to generate the huge trade exception and turn it into more value down the road was really the thing that put this over the top. And that, I mean, that Melton trade, you know, they potentially got a good player and a pick for pretty much nothing.
Yeah. That was
Am I being a homer here, or is that?
No. I think that was good. I think they did well to get what they did. I thought that they wouldn't have a better deal in the summer than would have been available at the trade deadline. That turned out to be wrong. And so
we felt pretty strongly that way. It would be easier to put a deal together that was more favorable in the summer, just because when you start stacking contracts to get to his number, you know, doing 3 and 4 for ones, and then the pick. So Utah was willing to put in their first round pick in 2019 with no conditions at all, because they already knew what number it was.
Yeah.
So that's where it gets a lot easier to do a deal before the draft, is that you don't have to do all the stuff with protections and what if it flips to next year, and then, you know, you don't have to get into all that, because the pick is a known. So it makes it easier to set deals up a lot of times.
No, I mean, that obviously was a deal that pushed Memphis into what's looking like it'll be a faster rebuild than many anticipated. Okay, here's what I wanted to throw out.
Okay.
The Washington Wizards not trading Bradley Beal.
Ooh, a non-move.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think
sometimes not making a move is riskier than making a move. People don't think of risk that way. They think of risk as a deviation from our current status quo, but sometimes you are taking a risk by not making a move.
Right, because obviously they could have been awful this year with or without Beal, and presumably he had as much trade value as about anyone. I mean, people are always looking for A, shooting, B, wings, C, guys who can play on the ball. Beal is one of the rare guys who are all three. I think virtually every team in the league would have had some kind of case for making a deal for him. They could have bid things up to a pretty high level. Now, they still will have that opportunity this summer, but there doesn't seem to be any intention of following through on that, at least at this point.
Yeah. Well, so they did. It looks better now than it did then, because he at least extended.
Yeah. You
know, we didn't even know that he was going to extend at that time.
Exactly.
So that looks better. But there's still the question of, where are you going with this guy now? Are they going to, they might be the A seed next year if John Wall comes back and he's okay. They don't really have much flexibility to improve this offseason. And things look a little bit better for them now with getting guys like Bertans and Mo Wagner and just generally playing a little bit better than it seemed like they were going to. But to me, would Bradley Beal have been an acceptable partner for Kawhi Leonard in LA?
Wow, that's a great point.
Yeah. Right. Like, maybe they could have gotten, if not quite as good of a package from as OKC got, even half of that package would have been pretty good, I think, to potentially jumpstart a rebuild.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of teams that really would have been very interested in trading for Beal. Would New Orleans have been interested in him? Maybe something along the lines of all those assets that they had, some of which went to, you know, maybe they could have gotten the number 4 pick. Not that that turned out to be anyone good, but we didn't know that at the time.
Exactly.
That would be an interesting one. I think where we're going to end up is, I mean, maybe he just really loves it there and wants to stay there, and he's fine winning 35 games a year in perpetuity. But you imagine at some point he's going to want out. And hey, even if he doesn't want out, winning 35 games a year in perpetuity doesn't help you much anyway. Because I don't see Beal as, he's not a get you to the playoffs on his own type of player, right? Those are the type of guys you hold on to in these circumstances. Beal is probably, you know, 15th, 20th best player in the NBA.
If he tries on defense. Yeah.
Okay, let's take another quick break here, and then we'll get another move from John. Okay, so what do you owe us now? A good one or a bad one? I've lost track.
Let's see. I've done two good ones. I think I've only done one bad one. So let me hit a bad one here. Sacramento Kings signed three different players as unrestricted free agents this summer to contracts north of $10 million a year and arguably got zero starters and one rotation player out of the deal, right? Dwayne Dedman, Trevor Ariza, and Corey Joseph.
Yeah, those guys didn't work out. I thought that would actually be, that's one of the ones that my opinion has changed on. Mm-hmm. So my question for you is, what else should they have done instead?
I mean, there are so many things they could have done. There's a sign better players, one, right? Like,
well, so
it wouldn't have been hard to do better than Dwayne Dedman. They could have given the same money to Daniel Tice, right? And Boston probably would have walked away.
Well, but is there any, so you thought Daniel Tice was better than Dwayne Dedman last summer? I definitely didn't.
I didn't expect Tice to have the year he had. That's a fair critique. I wasn't as big on Dedman as you were, but we're talking about guys who were, you know, ended up between 40th and 60th at their position. Like there were a lot of options here as far as other ways they could have gone, especially when you're talking about fives. I mean, one option at the five was them to just not sign anybody besides Rashawn Holmes, who, they give him credit, awesome move, and just played him and Harry Giles, right? Like you didn't have to keep Harry Giles in a freezer the whole season.
Yeah. They also could have just played the qualifying offer game with Willie Cauley-Stein, although that would have reduced their cap space because his cap hold was so big as a high pick.
Yes, yes. Although in retrospect, that might not have been such a bad thing to have their cap space restricted. And obviously, they grossly overpaid for a backup point guard, which you can't pay that kind of money at the backup one. It's just not a significant enough position. They're locked into Joseph next year at 12.6, has a small guarantee the year after. Ariza, I mean, at least Ariza was the 2-1, as you call it.
Yeah.
With the partial. He probably performed the best of the three, even though he was a disappointment too. But just all told, just, and for a team, so here's the other thing that bothered me about that, was that they went after three older guys at a point where they weren't really ready to win anything.
Yeah. That's reasonable, right? That to me is one of the best arguments. I think, you know, they felt like they're going to make the playoffs, and it was important for them to do that because it's I don't know if you heard, it's kind of been a while in Sacramento.
Yeah, but you know, instead of Corey Joseph, go after Tyus Jones, right? Go after DeLon Wright. Both those guys got less money.
Barely. Actually, no, I think that...
Both mid-level guys.
No, that's not true. Those got... Yeah, but they got... those guys both got 3 years fully guaranteed, right? So they actually got more money.
They got more money per year. But you're okay paying them out those years because they're in their 20s, right?
Yeah.
So...
Hey, Corey Joseph's not that old. Like, he's been around forever, but, like, he's only 27, 28. I mean, he's like within a year or two of Wright. But yeah, I mean, and also the other problem with Jones and Wright was they were restricted free agents. You didn't know that you were going to be able to get them right away, whereas you knew that you could get Joseph.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously those deals didn't work out. Like, I'm not arguing with you on that. Mm-hmm. I'm playing devil's advocate to some degree. Sure. But to me, in terms of guys who, yes, like they overpaid, it seemed at the time to me they were overpaying by like $3 or $4 million, something like that. And Dedman was a unique fit next to Bagley, and both of those guys had nightmare seasons, as it turned out. But the theory of Dedman, I thought, to overpay for the fit maybe more than the player, I thought that was all right if he had just shot the ball the way that he did last year, but he just didn't do that. So I thought, and then backup point guard, they just sucked when Fox was off the floor. I think they felt like, all right, if we can shore up this weakness, you know, we can be a mid-40s win team because we played so well when we had Fox out there last year. And as long as we're not playing like Yogi Ferrell or Frank Mason, all of a sudden, like, we're just putting a competent player out there will really help us. But so I thought the theory behind those moves was okay. Like, I can't kill them that badly for those. The guys just didn't, like, if they... Well, let me ask you this. If those guys had all just played the way they played the year before, would you be killing those moves still?
Well, I mean, I didn't think Corey Joseph was any good when they signed him, so I...
Yeah. Okay, so that's fair.
That one for sure.
I thought Ariza was like an above average backup point guard at the time.
Ariza wasn't good last year.
Aren't you always talking about how, like, defensive guards are underrated?
Yeah, but he's... Okay, he's like... but.
Yeah,
is he like Chris Dunn though? Like he's all right.
I mean, I think he can defend the one and the two. He's tough. I mean, he's not gonna force turnovers the way Chris Dunn did, but I don't know. This is an interesting discussion. I mean, I don't really have a leg to stand on because the moves themselves didn't work out. But I struggled to say that that's like one of my five worst moves of the offseason. I mean, we're not like definitively ranking these, but like the theory behind those made sense to me. But we disagree on that, it seems.
All right.
Anything else you want to do to make me sound stupid, or should we move on to the?
Let's move on to one you hated.
Okay, this wasn't that damaging, ultimately, but it probably made the least sense to me of any move.
Okay.
Jabari Parker on a 1+1 for $6 million a year with Atlanta.
It was only a matter of time before we got to Atlanta. Yeah, I don't know if there's a lot to say there. I mean, it was a dice roll with leftover cap room. Like, but at the same time, like, part of the reason they traded back for Dedmon was to get off of the $6 million they owed Parker next year. And I'm with you that I had zero faith that would work. But I actually have a better with a player from that same draft. I believe there was an even more egregiously bad 1+1 contract. And it was by a team that we usually do not knock. Can you think of what it is?
From that same draft on a 1+1.
I believe it was the same draft.
My brain is a little addled. Who is it?
The Toronto Raptors signed Stanley Johnson, 2 years, $7.5 million with a player option.
It was not the same draft, 2015. That's why. Okay. I clearly would have gotten it immediately. If only you'd been more accurate.
What's so interesting is that were it not for the development of players like Terrence Davis and, you know, Chris Boucher and whatnot, and them signing Hollis Jefferson at the back end of Toronto's rotation, this could have really been a disaster for them. Like, they didn't have a lot of room. They didn't have a lot of options in free agency. And this was kind of their taxpayer mid-level move, right?
They used the BAE on him, actually.
Okay. Yeah, my bad. And he was so bad that even in preseason, you heard people kind of like, this guy's pretty bad. Like, I don't think this is going to work.
Well, including his own coach
in
the media, just saying he was not buying into what they're trying to do. This is one, again, that, I mean, you're the proponent of the second draft, right? I mean,
It did not seem like a bad gamble at the time. So this is one that you file under, like, it seemed okay at the time.
The player option, raised my eyebrows at the time.
That was unnecessary. I would agree.
I mean, I thought Pat McCaw for 2 years, $8 million was a much worse decision.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although,
McCaw's been...
He has compromising photographs of the coaching staff, though, so that's...
But I mean, when you can pull all these awesome other guys out to go 4 for 5 on those type of signings and free agent guys, you still did pretty good there. But yeah, that's one that's, you know, who knows what's gonna happen to Stanley Johnson next year. But I mean, pretty amazing. I mean, you would think it'd be the best place for him. They develop guys so well. Okay.
Total mystery.
The Dallas Mavericks, we're back on the good side here.
Okay.
Re-signing Dorian Finney-Smith and Maxi Kleber to a combined $12 million a year.
Yeah, you see, I had an item that just said Dallas, and I wasn't sure where to go with it. I mean, that Kleber contract is awesome, right? It's 4 years, $34 million, fourth year as a partial. I mean, Kleber's really good, and he's still kind of a almost unknown player on a national level. And
yeah, he is number two when I did my awards for Sixth Man. I mean, no one talks about him like that, but to me, I mean, I think he's one of the most valuable reserves in the NBA.
Yeah, and then they got Finney-Smith again on a really value deal, 3 years, $12 million. I wasn't as high on him, but he's had a good year for them, and
he's really, really improved his shooting. I mean, he couldn't hit the broadside of a barn early in his career, and yeah, he's not like an absolute stopper, but you can throw him on most of these guys and he'll do a respectable job. And he's shooting the three well enough now that, I mean, to get a 3-and-D wing for $4 million a year, they did a great job of being proactive in the restricted free agency agency process with those guys, but still using restricted free agency to get him on value deals.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And they've done a nice job with him there, or he's done a nice job, give him the credit too, of turning into this kind of player. You could see at Florida that he had kind of some of those attributes of what could be a 3-and-D guy, but his skill level just wasn't at the right level for this league. And, you know, came there as an undrafted free agent and has just gotten better every year.
I do have a Dallas move coming up that I had among my worst, but you're back in the positive side of the ledger again here.
All right, let me go with some low hanging fruit on the positive side here. Well, I got two positives here, but okay, I'll go with this one because I wasn't sure about it at the time. I wasn't crazy about it, but Derrick Rose, 2 years, $15 million to the Pistons. That was a hell of a deal, man.
Yeah, I mean, think they could have won 15 games instead of 20 without him. No, I kid there. I mean, if Blake Griffin had been healthy, that actually would have been a good signing, and they might have even been in the playoffs. And they also have won 5 games fewer than expected. I mean, they've really been more of a 25-win team. And they also stopped drawing, obviously, once Griffin's surgery came down. But no, I mean, he's been outstanding. He's up there for discussion in Sixth Man of the Year, and I mean, man, where would they have been without him offensively?
Oh my goodness. It was amazing. You'd watch those first 5 minutes before they started him. You'd watch the first 5 minutes of the Pistons game. You just want to blow your brains out watching it. Just like, oh my God, this is so dull. Like, how many times did they run the first play of the game for Tony Snell? You know, you're watching Bruce Brown run pick and roll with Andre Drummond. Like, oh man. So anyway, yeah, big lift from Derrick Rose. And I mean, he was durable. He was pretty efficient. I mean, he was good. I'd say the only surprise is that they weren't able to get something for him at the trade deadline. I do wonder if they'll trade him this summer while they still have that contract. It would seem to be the right move for where they're heading.
Well, I think that there are teams that wanted him, but the reports were that they wanted a lottery pick. Now, every team that's ever tried to trade someone has started off with wanting a lottery pick. But I think the fact that he was under contract for next year made them want to keep him around. I agree with you. I would have taken... I mean, if it was, I'll take that back. If it was like a second, I probably would have held on to him, actually. Yeah.
What I had heard was they wanted a first. They may not have been able to get that. I mean, Marcus Morris was the only guy who went for a first, I think, and he went for a very late one. So,
okay. I'll go back to Dallas here.
Okay.
The Dwight Powell extension of 3 years. $33 million kicks in after this year. Now, of course, we didn't know that he was going to tear his Achilles, and he actually played pretty well. He was part of them being so good offensively, but they've managed to keep that up pretty much without him. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is one of the best role men in the league, but 27 already, so that kicks in. So you're getting his age 28 to 30 seasons for a guy who's relying on athleticism. And I just think that with this team, and I'll say this too, like that bites into their 2021 cap space for a team that really should be able to move into contention right around that time with Luka and Porzingis.
Yeah, 21 is their key summer. No doubt about it. Yeah.
Well, and they had him under contract for another year. I thought when the reports emerged that they were going to sign him to extension, I thought it was going to be he's going to opt out, and then they'd sign him to 3 more years, but at a lower per year number. And no, it was actually he opts in, and then you sign him to more. And he's not a plus defensive player who they really need at that position. Next to Porzingis, they need someone who can defend on the perimeter. Powell, to me, doesn't move his feet all that well because Porzingis needs to be near the basket. It just didn't make a lot of sense to me to spend that kind of money on him where you've got reasonable facsimiles of him that are available for a lot cheaper. And it's just, he is an elite role man, but is he going to maintain that for the next 3 years after this? And there's just the ultimate thing was there's just no urgency to do this.
That's the thing, right? Why?
Yeah.
Yeah. You just didn't need to do that.
And I mean, the fact that he tore his Achilles, which is terrible, but that's why you don't do it a year ahead of time for a player like that, unless you're getting, normally when you say, okay, fine, extension, we'll give you an extension, but we're going to give you extra certainty here. So give us a little bit of a discount, right? That's usually how it's supposed to work. And instead I thought that they overpaid in the extension.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although I'll say this, I think I have a worse contract extension.
Eric Gordon?
No, same position, different team. CJ McCollum, 3 years, $100 million with the Portland Trail Blazers.
Yeah, that's one why? Where...
Why?
Win the press battle, I guess.
He's not a free agent until the summer of 21. Like, you just didn't need to do this. And now they're just completely locked in on this, you know, Lillard McCollum backcourt, which is like, okay, like, is CJ really the right guy to have next to Lillard?
I've defended that pairing over the years. Because I'm not sure who you're like trading McCollum for that is really going to improve you that much more than what he's already giving you. And those two guys are really difficult to defend. I mean, whenever those two guys are on the floor, their offense has been really, really good for a long time. But that's an interesting one because, I mean, he's played about, you know, his normal level this year, which he does have that one 16-17 year that's like a little bit of an outlier. You know, he hasn't quite, where that year he was a borderline all-star, he hasn't been quite at that level.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I definitely wouldn't have done that. And I mean, maybe they felt that that would actually increase his trade value to have him under contract.
Oh, but, the old Kevin Love fallacy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, but I mean, he's at least still producing. Generally, if the guy is still producing, that can work.
He's 28. He's not a top 10 player at his position, probably. Probably never will be. He's not a $30 million player. And there's no chance of him becoming one.
Yeah, I think I had him at like 7th when I did my shooting guard rankings. But that's eye of the beholder, obviously. Whether you like him more or you like a more well-rounded 3-and-D type at that position depends on what you need. But it certainly could turn out to be really bad. I mean, I think that's quite obvious to me.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of risk in that one.
Eric Gordon might end up being worse, though, given the fact that he hasn't even produced this year.
Yeah.
And he's got big health concerns.
Yep. Still,
that's the one thing about CJ. He at least has stayed almost entirely healthy this year, or in his career, I should say.
Yeah. Gordon's got 3 guaranteed years after this one. Yeah, that one's not great. And that was another one where there was, you know, what was the urgency there?
If he'd had a good year, I think also a lot of these teams didn't anticipate that the free agent market in the summer of 2020 was basically going to be the mid-level exception for good teams.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was easy to see, though. There weren't going to be any good teams with room. So it was just a question of whether a bad team was going to overpay your 30-year-old or whatever, you know, player. So for veteran extension, like, I understand, like, there were all these rookie contract extensions that were signed this fall. They all made sense to me because there were a bunch of teams that were going to have cap room that were in rebuilding situations. When you looked at Atlanta, Cleveland at the time, Memphis at the time, Charlotte, the Knicks, you knew were going to be back in it again.
Yeah, the forlorn five, as you so glibly dubbed them.
Now, a couple of those identities have changed, right? Memphis used its cap room. Phoenix could be a room team potentially. Cleveland's room has shifted to Detroit, but it's the same idea, basically. It's all rebuilding teams that have the room.
Yeah, I agree. So, I mean, it's really the mid-level exception you're dealing with, unless there's sign-in trades or something like that, which that has its own issues. Okay, give me, let's do one more good one, and then there's a few that we just, like, I want to discuss, even if they're not on our best and worst.
All right, here's one that I really like. So, another shout-out here for the Oklahoma City Thunder. Russell Westbrook for Chris Paul. They got Chris Paul on a deal that's 1 year shorter than Westbrook's. They got a first round pick in 2024 and 26, protected top 4 only. They have a swap right with the first and 25 that's top 10 protected. I mean, they got some good draft capital out of this, and they took a year off of Westbrook's deal, and they reshaped the identity of the team so that the other guys on the court can actually play.
Yeah, and they got someone who contributed to them more this year than Russell Westbrook probably would have.
Yeah, exactly. Tom.
So, I mean, there's a few things that are important to remember here as we look at this in retrospect. Chris Paul being 18th in the NBA in total minutes played was not something I think a lot of people could have seen coming.
Fair.
And that he would continue to play at this level and be an all-star and an all-NBA candidate. So that it seemed more likely than not that ship had kind of sailed for him, and that maybe if you could really ramp him up in the playoffs and just get him to be at his absolute best at that time, he could still be really good. I thought there there's a chance he might be a better playoff contributor for them than Westbrook. And then Westbrook started off so poorly, in part because of the fit issues, in part because he's returning from that knee surgery. But then seeing what he did the last month and a half or so, does that change things about this for you? Do you think that Westbrook gave Houston a higher ceiling in the playoffs than Paul would have, seeing the way that he was playing?
So that's why the way I phrased it was, I love this deal for Oklahoma City. I don't necessarily hate it for Houston, right? Like, I get why Houston did what they did, even though they paid a price for it and it might fail.
Yeah, Daryl Morey assumes that he's going to be fired, and so why not just throw away all these draft assets in the future and he won't be there anymore? That's what you meant, right?
Well, there's that aspect of it, but also even in the short, even in the immediate term, converting Paul into Westbrook and what that could do for his team, and could that, you know, could making that shift get them up another level in the Western Conference. I didn't hate that particular gamble, but from Oklahoma City's perspective, obviously, to get two firsts and convert Westbrook into Paul, and losing that 2022 year at $48 million, I mean, that has a lot of value when you're in a rebuilding situation. And you're paying, because like, what does Westbrook look like in, at that point in his career when he's still trying to do the things he does now, but he maybe doesn't have the jets to do it? That, like, that could get ugly.
I agree with you. And the other thing too is, just from an emotional standpoint, it allowed them to rebuild. I'm sure they would have felt like they, given what Westbrook had done for the organization, that they had an obligation to put a competitive team around him. And now they have carte blanche to just go ahead and rebuild in whatever fashion they wanted to do.
Yeah, exactly. So, and ironically, they ended up being pretty good this year, and now it's almost like that year that Phoenix had with Hornacek.
13-14, yeah.
Yeah, where it actually complicates everything you do going forward. So they're going to have to make some hard decisions here about where they think they are and where they think they can get to with this group. Because it's a weird situation, because really, I mean, their two best players are still older guys. You know, Gallinaro might not be back. CP's their best player. You know, Schroeder had a really good year for him, but he's not really part of the future. You know, even Steven Adams only has one more year on his deal. So they got to make some hard decisions.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I was talking about this the other day on my mailbag podcast that I did with Danny, about how now if for some reason the playoffs don't end up happening, it's maybe harder to move on from something. Because I was expecting, I know we disagreed on this, that they would, you know, flame out in the playoffs pretty quickly going up against some real teams. Mm-hmm. But and so then it makes it easier to be like, okay, you know, it's not like I know we won 50 games here, but it's not like we were headed anywhere special.
Right.
With these guys. I mean, it's a little easier for them than that 13-14 Suns team that won 48 games but didn't make the playoffs, because that team was young enough where you felt like, okay, we've got a group we can build with. Here, I don't think that's the case. And then they also have so many draft picks from other teams in the future that being bad themselves isn't necessarily as much of a priority. Okay, so we got about maybe 15 minutes left here. The AD trade, what's your assessment of that as we look, whatever it is, 8 months now in the rearview mirror?
Well, obviously the Lakers botched the cap part and ended up having to give away Isaac Bonga and Mo Wagner because of it in the separate deal with Washington. As far as the deal they made with New Orleans, I would have done that deal to get Anthony Davis if I knew he wanted to be there. Like, I didn't have any problem with what they gave up. I thought New Orleans drove a good bargain for themselves and got the best deal that they could. I thought that was a very fair trade.
Well, and AD and LeBron, I mean, the Lakers have been better than most people thought they would be this year, and to be a clear number one seed in the West, clear championship contender, I'm not sure that everyone thought they would necessarily be that. Now, when they, at the time they did the trade, they also thought it might be possible to get Kawhi Leonard, it might be possible to do something else in free agency that would add a third star that would really catapult them immediately in. As it turned out, they couldn't get that, but still, I mean, their team was really, really good. The big thing you just have to look back on, though, is to have it structured in a way where you couldn't trade another first round pick, like to have to 2021 where it only goes if it's in the top seven. You're telling me you couldn't have gotten that deal done without that stipulation, or you couldn't have gotten the deal done without a deferment that basically prevents you trading a pick for 4 years?
Exactly. Yeah, that's they got themselves in a lot of trouble there, and it hurt them badly when the bidding came down for Marcus Morris in particular, right? Because they were outmaneuvered. They didn't have the pick that the Clippers did to put in that deal.
Yeah, agreed. So another one we talked about Westbrook. Another move that I was very critical of two teams for not making, I said that the Wolves, who started off at number 6 and traded down with the Suns, giving up Dario Saric. The Wolves were at 11 and the Suns were at 6. So the Suns traded down to 11. Wolves went up to 6, giving up Dario Saric for the privilege. I thought both of those teams erred in not drafting Coby White. The Suns moved down. They drafted Cam Johnson. Wolves drafted Jarrett Culver. White hasn't been unbelievable. He was coming on some in the absence of Zach LaVine. But Culver hasn't been great. And Cam Johnson's looked okay, but he's also 24 and doesn't have a ton of upside.
Yeah, there's some.
Was I right about that? Should I have been crapping on them for that as much, given how all those players have performed now?
I think Coby White clearly has the best future of the three of them. He's the youngest. He's shown the most as a rookie. Really started turning the corner in March, right before we shut everything down. So yeah, I think your analysis is looking on target on that one. Yeah, I agree with you on that.
Yeah, and now you might say, well, do the Suns get Rubio? I think they actually could have still gotten Rubio and brought White off the bench for a couple of years, and then hopefully he could move into a starter role.
Well, look at the backups that Phoenix was playing this year. I mean, sheesh.
Right. Yeah, he might have even helped them a little bit. And then the Wolves, maybe they just always had eyes for D'Angelo Russell. I think that probably they thought they were going to get Russell in free agency. It seemed like they had pretty good degree of confidence.
So the story I've heard is actually the Wolves like Garland. And we went right before their pick.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people liked Garland better than White. I probably would like White better than Garland at this point.
I wasn't as high on Garland as some other people. We didn't have a ton of film to work with on him, obviously.
Yeah, that worked in his favor, as it turned out.
Exactly. It was like
We know the rest of these guys.
The American Mario Hezonja.
Anything else that stuck out to you that you want to talk about here?
There's a deal we didn't talk about that I'm surprised didn't come up. It was the one I still had left on my list here.
Oh, yeah.
Al-Farouq Aminu to Orlando, 3 years, $29 million with a player option.
Isn't that outcome-based decision-making because he was never healthy? Or you thought it was bad to begin with?
So I actually didn't think it was bad to begin with. I thought it was okay at the time. So I'm just saying, part of this is we're looking at the offseason with 2020 hindsight now, right? And it's like, I mean, even before he went out with the injury, his fit in that offense was like, whoa. Like this, he pushed it over the edge in terms of being a low shooting, low skill offense to begin with. And once he came in, it just went careening off the cliff.
Yeah, now he was playing on one leg. I'm not sure that I would say that. I mean, you would have thought he's no worse than like John Isaac is, right? So you could, they didn't have any other wings at all. You could at least get, 48 minutes of really good defense at forward across both positions now. So like, I didn't think it was a great fit, but I also thought it's a starting quality player for 3 years at the mid-level, and they needed a backup at the three. They didn't have anything there.
Yeah, and again, I'm not questioning the logic of this as much as just, wow, that didn't work out at all.
Well, and retaining Nick Vucevic and Terrence Ross hasn't really looked that great for Orlando either, right?
Well, I mean, you could say their goal was to get back in the playoffs, and they're going to do that, presuming the season resumes.
Congratulations. we get to bet and see whether they eclipse last year's Pistons for like the worst first-round playoff loss ever.
Well, we also have the worst playoff seeding battle ever if the league comes back and plays more games between Brooklyn and Orlando for that 7 seed.
Oh, man, that's the most tragic thing that I've heard yet, that we're going to be deprived of that down the stretch. Well, you know what else I'm surprised didn't come up? Mm-hmm. Tobias Harris and Al Horford.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I had a separate column for the Sixers. Yeah, 5 years, $180 million for Harris. Horford, 4 years, $109 million, $95 million guaranteed. Yeah. I mean, to me, Tobias Harris is the sunk cost fallacy, right? Like, because they gave up all this stuff to trade for him, they felt like they had to overpay him in free agency to keep him. Obviously, nobody else was giving him 5 years, $180 million.
Like, well, I think he would have had 4-year max offers.
You think he would have had max offers?
What about Utah?
They could have come in. I'm trying to think. They did Bogdanovich at like 17. Did they have enough room for a max after they did everything else?
Maybe they could have like got off a Dante Exum or something. I think they, and also maybe they do that instead of Conley as well. I know Conley happened at the draft, but I think there were
Lakers could have done Tobias Harris on a 4-year max. Sure. That was probably what they were most worried about as I think about it. Or the Knicks because he's a New York guy. I could have seen that, maybe. Okay, all right.
I think it was pretty clear that was out there. But, yeah, Ed Horford, I mean, wow, $28 million for this year. 4 years, 112. Last year, half guaranteed. Although it does guarantee fully if they win a championship.
Yeah.
And just to choose those two guys over Jimmy Butler and J.J. Redick.
Well, Jimmy Butler didn't choose them, but...
What if they offered him the money that he wanted? That's ultimately what it was, right? Or do you think it's more just he didn't want to be there because of personal conflicts or something?
I thought he just didn't want to be there. I didn't think it was about the getting the fifth year, because he couldn't get the fifth year anywhere else anyway.
Well, I think so, because he didn't want to be in Minnesota after they didn't create space to renegotiate and extend him. He would have been happy to be there supposedly before that. And then there was always so much talk about like, okay, he's got all these max offers. They were trying to leak stuff to the media about Houston and, it seemed like they're always trying to drum up a market for him. I think if they offered him the 5-year max, he would have stayed. I mean, that's a whole...
That's a great what if.
Yeah, it could have been pretty ugly in a while, sure. But Jimmy Butler does things that are special, at least now, and Tobias Harris does not. I mean, I think that's ultimately what it comes down to. Yeah, Tobias is younger, better health history. Okay, that's all great, but you're still just getting like a solid starter for your $33 million a year.
Yeah.
And then more than that.
Yeah.
More than that, actually.
Yeah. And then on Horford, in 2020 hindsight, they'd have been better off just signing a regular big, with their Mike Scott money, just sign a regular decent five, which there were plenty out there, and then use that money to get some people who could actually dribble and shoot.
Now, I will say this about Horford. I do think he was hurt, this Achilles soreness. He definitely really dropped off. I would still like to see what it would look like if you were totally healthy. You just never know with that stuff how much it's affecting people.
But that's part of the deal, though, when you sign somebody at this point in their career. They're going to be dinged up.
Yeah, I'm just not ready to fully declare that their idea here behind that starting lineup just can't possibly work.
Mm-hmm. And that's why ultimately I didn't have it in my top five. It's not like an unmitigated disaster, right? It's one you look back and you say, ooh, man, I don't know.
Yeah, and they did get Josh Richardson, obviously, for Butler. They wouldn't have had him. I mean, it really was... No, I messed it up. It really was about either Richardson and Horford or Butler and J.J. Redick. That was really the choice that they had.
Yeah.
Because Harris was going to say... He had the low cap hold regardless. That's part of why I think they wanted to bring him back too, because his cap hold was only $22 million.
Yeah, exactly. So he still enabled him to do the other stuff.
But yeah, I mean, that doesn't look amazing right now.
not at all.
All right. Well, what did you write about for The Athletic this week?
Well, I'm actually looking at, I just filed the story. It might be out by the time you guys listen to this. Looking at all the different player and team options on contracts heading into this offseason. And I did a little back and forth on the Hawks with our Atlanta beat writer, Chris Kirshner. So check out that two-part series from the end of last week, too, if you haven't already.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. Chris had some interesting reporting about Trae Young and Lloyd Pierce in that article, which I thought was good. TheAthletic.com/PER, by the way, is how you can sign up. They have a great deal right now with 90 days free at the start of your subscription. So that's pretty impressive. And also for my podcast, I've been doing a daily coronavirus news roundup with my friend Ben Taylor. And from what I understand, there's not that many podcasts that are actually doing anything like that right now. We're not trained epidemiologists, but we are trained news aggregators and podcasters. And Ben has a pretty rigorous background. I'm trying to get up to speed, but just to relay news in a responsible way of what's going on with the coronavirus. The idea is you can listen to this for a half hour every day and you get your news, and then you can go around, go about your day instead of having to read a bunch of news and obsess over it and try to find the stuff that's the most salient for you, just kind of trust us to curate that for you. That's kind of the idea there. Because I know for a lot of people, it's been just what to read and what to believe has been a difficult process, and you're spending a lot of time doing it and kind of stressing yourself out. Obviously, we need to know what's going on with this, but that, you know, we don't need to spend 6 hours a day doing it. That's kind of the thought behind this show. All right. I think that's all we got. We'll talk to y'all next week. Till then.